Hello everyone and welcome to the Green Minds podcast, a podcast dedicated to thought-provoking conversations on climate change and sustainability. My name is Eva and I'm your host for this episode. This episode looks at the blue economy, the impact of climate change on the oceans, and the importance of protecting them. My guest today is Matilda De Silva, founder and CEO of the award-winning social enterprise Ocean Purpose Project based in Singapore. Matilda worked as a broadcast and print journalist for over a decade before moving into social media community management and sustainability advocacy. She is a specialist in blue economy and blue carbon and has spoken at various events and summits, including the G20, the United Nations Ocean Conference, and COP27. Ocean Purpose Project aims to solve the ocean pollution crisis and promote ocean conservation. The goal is to create a movement that drives ocean conservation and plastic pollution prevention through disruptive and creative projects with mass impact. Projects of Ocean Purpose Project include creating bioplastics from native seaweed and shellfish, building traditional seaweed-fertilized herb gardens for the public, and converting plastics to fuel. To do this, the Ocean Purpose Project brings together the world's best engineering and research partners. I'm very happy to talk to Matilda about the blue economy and the role of oceans, as well as her journey and work at Ocean Purpose Project. Welcome to the Green Minds podcast, Matilda. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Eva. Thanks for having me on board.
Before we jump into the topic, would you like to share with us what led you to become the founder of Ocean Purpose Project and what is the idea behind the Ocean Purpose Project?
I don't know. How much time have you got, Eva? This is a very long and complicated story.
Just start and we'll see.
Well, so I used to paddle dragon boat competitively for Singapore. I mean, I wasn't like some superstar gold medalist, but I was in an overseas race in Boracay in the Philippines. And it was a weekend, you know, we paddled, we went diving, we were swimming, we were in dragon boats, we were partying. And after just a week of participating in this race, I came back to Singapore and then I was hospitalized. My immune system had crashed and, you know, I assumed that maybe it was something I ate. The official word was that, you know, they had served bad rice during the catering of the event. But a month later, I discovered that my skin was slowly turning white. My hair was also, you know, overnight, suddenly my hair turned white. I started to develop muscular spasms. I started to have a terrible digestive system. I also had a lot of difficulties with my eyes. Even holding a pen became a massive challenge. And I lost my voice for 6 months. And it was a big mystery as to why I was falling so sick. And I really couldn't put my finger on it, what was actually causing this. And, you know, it was actually obvious that this major event in 2015, which was actually an exposure to ocean pollution, I only realized in 2018 that the waters of Boracay were so polluted because in 2018, the government of the Philippines actually closed the island for over 6 months due to gross environmental violations where they discovered they were pumping raw sewage, chemicals, all form of waste in the island was actually going into those very same touristic beaches that I was paddling in. And I'm actually just coming from a conference right now and I had shared this story because a lot of people were like, I don't understand, you're a TV producer, you're a social media person, why would you go off and start a social enterprise around converting ocean pollution to solutions, very technical, you don't have a background as an engineer, you don't have a background as a biologist. And one of the things that I do realize is, yes, they're absolutely right. I don't have that background. I'm a TV producer. I'm a content person. I'm a social media lead. That's my background. I'm a community manager. But the one thing that I do have in common with millions of people in Southeast Asia is that I don't like the word victim, but I am actually a victim of water pollution. And unlike the millions around Southeast Asia that don't have anybody that can speak for them or articulate what the issues are or even show what it looks like, what it feels like, and also how difficult it is to live the kind of life that I used to live. You know, I wasn't an athlete, but I was pretty fit. You know, I was in front of the camera, I was behind the camera. All of these things really came to a crashing halt. And so this is again where why Ocean Purpose Project and why I started this is really because I wanted to find a purpose out of what had happened to me. I didn't want this to be yet another awareness creation mechanism. I wanted this to be something real, something that is about solution engineering. So that's why I started it.
Thank you so much for sharing this journey and your personal background. That's very interesting. And yeah, on the one side, it's a sad story, but also a powerful story. So thank you so much for sharing this. Maybe you can dive a bit deeper into the projects that Ocean Purpose does. What's your daily work and what projects are you currently working on?
Okay, so Ocean Purpose Project, we focus on turning pollution into solutions. We have three core pillars. The first is about tackling plastic pollution. So I think in every country, in every beach in the world, you've got NGOs, community groups, schools, you know, people who do beach cleanups. You know, there's a lot of plastic that washes up. Of course, the beach where Ocean Purpose Project's offices are headquartered in the north of Singapore in Pasir Ris, we have a massive amount of plastics that are washing up almost on a daily basis. The big question is, okay, we do a cleanup, but then where does all of that plastic go to? And so, you know, we started with a very simple question, which is if plastic comes from oil, why don't we turn it back into oil again and create a profit motive from this? But take it one step further and say we're not going to perpetuate fossil fuel as we know it, but we're actually able to take it a step further and convert those ocean plastics into hydrogen. And that's really what that first pillar is about. It's about, you know, stitching together the wealth of academic innovation as well as operational excellence from multiple different fields. This could be the energy field, this could be plastics, this could be shipping, transportation, land transportation. Stitching together all of that expertise and saying, how do we create mobile plastic to hydrogen units or OPP-PTEF units that can travel over land and sea, that can be parked next to a landfill, and literally chug away all of those materials and turn them into beneficial products, beneficial fuels such as hydrogen. And of course, when you burn hydrogen, you produce energy and water. And so that's the first pillar. The second pillar is about how do we prevent what happened to me in Boracay from happening again? And this is very poignant because right now on the beaches of Pasir Ris, which is where you know, I live in that town, but our offices are also headquartered, we're having a terrible bacterial bloom. And I can tell you personally how bad that bacterial bloom is. About 2 weeks ago, I was doing a cleanup. Some of the seawater splashed into my eye. And I already have Sjogren's syndrome, which is a form of autoimmune. So that coupled with that dirty water, I was actually in the hospital for 2 days. I went blind. You know, so again, I don't know how many more times I have to physically prove the link between ocean health and human health, but nobody knows about this issue of chemical pollution at sea better than, or feels it more acutely than I do, I would say. A lot of people know more about it. I feel it acutely. And so the second pillar that we're working on, which is using native species of seaweed and mussels to perform bioremediation on floating fish farms, which are very common here in my town in the north of Singapore. Basically, what we do is we partner with traditional and indigenous farmers to grow seaweed and mussel lines. We plant everything, we pay for everything. The farmer doesn't pay a cent for any of that. In fact, we even help the farmer to improve the flotation devices on their floating farm. You know, we even do all of the planting and the purchase of the materials ourselves, the water quality assessments to make sure that we can actually prove that our seaweed and mussel lines are absorbing excess nitrates, nitrites, phosphates, ammonia, carbon even, from the sea. So this is again where that's a powerful solution because we're using nature-based solutions. We're integrating to existing smallholder farms, but we are actually like creating an energy-free system. My seaweed and mussel lines, I always joke with my staff that they are some of my best, hardest working staff. They work 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, no leave, no MC, you know, they're doing their work. And I give you some perspective. One mussel filters 10 liters of seawater an hour. One mussel. One line has a minimum of 200 mussels. Add to that, so if you calculate, let's say in a day, right, one line is maybe filtering a minimum of about 240 liters of seawater. We have about 300 to 400 seaweed mussel lines that have been planted. So if you do the math, just in a day, how many liters of seawater that, like, you know, our solutions are filtering. If you were to implement a machine to do this, the amount of energy it consumes, you know, the obsolescence of the machine after about 6 months in a high humidity location like Southeast Asia, it would break. It's heavy. You know, it's expensive. Of course, these machines are expensive. I think I saw a quote for about $25,000 per machine. It only lasts for about 6 months, 1 year. And we are doing all of that with native species of seaweed and mussels. And the added bonus is that we are attracting biodiversity to the location. So, you know, this is again where these two projects are very firmly rooted in science, you know, in citizen science, in observation, in also the integration of indigenous and traditional knowledge of community. We're also pioneering research. We are one of the first people in Pasir Ris on Singapore, so to speak, to have documented over 20 species of seaweeds that grow natively in our town. We even send some of these seaweed strains to farms in Indonesia for them to repopulate their commercial seaweed farms. So that's again where these two projects are really about saying, how do we tackle plastic pollution? How do we tackle chemical pollution and turn those into solutions? And the last pillar is behavior change. I know, because I used to do this for a living, you know, creating campaign awareness or, you know, sharing more about the pollution problem. And okay, this is important, but it's been 20, 30, 40 years of us talking about how our oceans are polluted. You know, we need less talk and a lot more action, you know, and this is again where behavior change for us is about telling, you know, school kids that work with us that, you know, I don't want you to go off and make me a paper mache artwork about why pollution is bad. Oh, no, no. You guys are going to work together with us and fishermen and come up with, for example, I'll give you an actual project that's happening with Dunman High School. The students are spectacular, I will say. I think they're 14, 15 years old. What they're doing is they're taking prawn shell waste, creating a bioplastic from it, chitosan-based. They're adding in our herbs that we grow at our Ocean Purpose Project beach office. And they're actually running tests to see if this kind of bioplastic degrades in seawater, can it kill algae bloom? Initial results prove that it is actually mildly successful. And that's what we talk about when we mobilize schools, when we try to get, when we want to change behaviors. You know, we're really getting young people to be hands-on, to be participatory, to really find solutions and stop just focusing on problems.
Thank you so much, Matilda. Thank you for introducing these three pillars of Ocean Purpose Project. That was very interesting. I would like to take a step back and look at the broader context of today's episode and the topic of today's episode. I introduced that today's topic is the blue economy and the important role of oceans. And I think there are many definitions of the term blue economy. Would you like to share with us what is blue economy, or how would you define blue economy?
Okay, so I think, you know, everything that we do at the Ocean Purpose Project is literally about understanding the role of blue economy to be able to create an ecosystem of solutions to an ecosystem of pollutions that we are facing. So, as I understand it, the blue economy is basically an offshoot of what we understand as the marine economy. So that would be, you know, traditionally you would look at that as either energy or, of course, shipping, maritime industry. But really what the blue economy aims to do is to be a sustainable use of ocean resources that benefits the economies that live and thrive off it. Then, of course, that slingshots into building of livelihoods, the interconnectivity of livelihoods, and then most importantly, not just describing those economic activities that are associated with oceans and seas, but really being able to map how this ocean ecosystem can continue to thrive, can continue to be healthy. And I think one of the key needs also is that we are trying to preserve the health of the ocean, but the world is also very actively plundering
and causing the demise of many systems within our oceans that are also breaking down. And I mean, if we zoom into plastics now, I want to kind of like also qualify. A lot of people, when they talk about, you know, ocean pollution, it's plastic pollution. I actually know of the gentleman who came up with the phrase that by 2050, there will be more plastic in the sea than fish. You know, I actually met him at a conference, at a United Nations conference, and he's spectacular at coming up with these zingers, these one-liners. And, you know, we had a very in-depth conversation about, you know, this vision that plastic pollution is the main cause of ocean pollution. If you actually looked at, like, data, you will see that possibly maybe about 5 to 7% of ocean pollution is marine litter, and plastics sit within that marine litter. What makes up the bulk then of that ocean pollution? We're looking at things like sewage. We're looking at things like agricultural runoff. That constitutes 50%. 50%. So if we want to talk about sustaining the oceans and ensuring that we are dealing with, let's say, the 50% of what's causing ocean pollution, we also have to talk about food systems. So what we eat as humankind, and of course, what our livestock eats, that's literally contributing to the poor health of the ocean ecosystem. So how do we basically understand how blue economy comes into this, right? It's really about us sitting and being smart about the definitions of economic activities related to this industry, and then mapping and saying, how do we go off and figure out economic strategies that link in energy, transport, agriculture, fisheries, coastal resources, maritime industry, together with the need to incorporate climate mitigation, climate adaptation strategies, coastal fortification strategies. These are all things that are, of course, going to have economic impact. So I had a riveting discussion today with someone about sea level rise in Singapore. They had no idea that this was an issue. Oh, I can tell you, this gentleman works in insurance. So, you know, this is again where, you know, the link between rising sea level, even just properties beside the coastline, you can already see like and map economic value on that. And so this is where the pillars of blue economy, which is, of course, primarily economic, but then also environmental and social. I would add another pillar, which is governance. So these four pillars are really what will be able to transform the way that we currently look at the blue economy. I mean, to be honest with you, most people think of it as just shipping or, of course, energy derived from the sea activity. It's really about saying, how do we build those pillars and plug that in, you know, understand how the relationship between overexploitation of marine resources, overfishing, illegal fishing, fishing slavery vessels, very common in Asia, destructive practices of deep sea mining, for example, energy extraction, even, of course, shipping itself, right? How do we balance that with the need to provide the world with food, with energy, with goods, services? And I think, like, you know, this is again where, as a blue economy specialist, my role is not just to wear the hat of an NGO. Yes, we are an NGO. Yes, we also call attention to when there's greenwashing, we call attention to pollution. But my hat is also to look at how do we map potential markets, services, and products that can come from the blue economy. There's something very interesting about blue economy, and I wanted to share this bit, right? Blue economy, actually, there's two definitions of it. There is the definition when you are talking about, like, you know, let's say related to oceans and things. There's also, I don't know if you've heard about this before. Have you heard about red, blue, and black economies? Have you heard of these terms?
No, I haven't heard about it. What's that about?
Okay, so this is actually like a theory. Let me explain this maybe a little bit better. I'm going to use some of the definitions with regards to red and blue economy. It's a concept developed by these INSEAD professors, and one of them is known as Gunther Pauli. And that blue economic theory is about saying the blue economy is about regenerative products and services. You know, the red economy is literally like, you know, the current economies that we know that exist right now. You know, and it's very interesting because it's a concept of, okay, I'll give you an example. An example of a blue economy company is Cirque du Soleil. They don't use animals. They use humans in their circuses. You know, so of course, that aspect of animal cruelty being addressed, as opposed to red economy business, which is a very classic example of what a circus would have been, where animals would have been featured in those circuses. They would have probably been engaged in very abusive practices. So you can already see in that, in Gunther Pauli's definition of blue economy, there is something new. There is an open market strategy. There is a regenerative aspect to it. There is a big sea. There's a blue sea perspective as opposed to the small pond perspective, which is very common in a red economy. And I think what I've always been very interested in is how do we marry these two definitions of blue economy into one and really push what it means to currently define all of the economic activities within the ocean sphere to become something that is regenerative, to become something that is about borrowing from everyone, thinking of nature and humanity in a different perspective. So that's also something that's very important for me as a blue economist to articulate, to push for. And I'm not just talking about it when I say, oh, seaweed is fantastic as a regenerative crop. I don't just talk about it. I actually grow it. You know, I grow it, I harvest it. I understand when, like, you know, when it has disease, I know the difficulties of trying to harvest it, to even plant it. I've tried, I've failed. And I think that's also the hallmark of what the blue economy needs. We need people to, we need ideators, not idealists. We need people who are implementers, not like, you know, people who are influencers, just talking about what's important. So this is also where I feel the blue economy articulation to me is about people who are able to really pull together what are the key economic activities within this sector that can adopt the principles of regenerative sustainability.
Thank you so much. And you already touched upon the topics of the important role of oceans regarding climate change, and also the importance of implementing or creating adaptation strategies and protecting the oceans. And one other instrument which I want to talk about are blue bonds. What would you say about blue bonds? Are they an effective strategy, and can they be useful for protecting our oceans and do something against climate change and the impacts of climate change to our oceans? What would you say?
Okay, so let's define first. So according to the World Bank, they would define the blue bond as your debt instrument, right? So this is issued by governments, development banks. You know, the aim is to raise capital to finance marine and ocean-based projects. And the aim is also to basically like try and signal to the market that, like, you know, through the blue bond, now we are also sending the market a signal that other forms of capital investment is set to come in to finance this transition, right, in the blue economy towards something more regenerative. Couple of things with that. You know, it's really about saying within these issuances of blue bonds, who are the first players, who are the benchmarks of projects that are implemented that receive these first monies? What are the metrics of success to determine that these projects are really addressing a diverse range of sectors and economic activities within blue economy? The metrics that clearly map, track, impact data around ocean health, whatever their key areas within blue economy are, and also how these are lead to regenerative practices. So I think as somebody who runs an NGO, as somebody who runs a social enterprise that is actually looking for funding of course, I'm going to say, you know, blue bonds are a fantastic idea. You know, I'm also going to say we need more. We need every single Asian country or, you know, to be basically issuing something. The key issue is how do we track the first players as being the benchmark for industry? I'll tell you why. Of course, there are a lot of my counterparts who are looking for funding and are also, you know, hoping to be among those players. Nobody wants governance, right? Nobody wants to have to abide by very strict audit processes or even impact metrics. Nobody wants to have auditors come in every 2-3 years to check the veracity of claims made by these impact projects, let alone have real-time systems in place. But what happens when these first players fail in their compliance checks and, of course, subsequently throw trust in blue bonds as a whole? This has happened before with the voluntary carbon market. This has happened before with various financing schemes. What happens there is you literally have the tsunami effect that is basically going to affect everybody down the chain, the good players, the ones who have good governance, the ones who have very robust reporting structures, the ones who are able to quantify amazing impact. They suffer because they are impacted by the lack of due diligence performed by those who were, you know, beneficiaries of the first blue bonds. And so I think what is really, really important for me is not only that they issue it, but, you know, get it done right in the first go, which means, and as a social media person, right, I still sometimes scratch my head because I cannot understand what is the role of like 10,000 consultants and like a 4-year, 5-year research and like, you know, sustainability reports that take so long when we, you know, in social media, I have a dashboard, 5 screens. I can tell to the nanosecond consumer behavior and like, you know, and performance of social media posts. I have no idea why we cannot do and implement these kinds of real-time systems in sustainability, but that's another podcast on its own. I can go about that for hours. Yes, I want to see like massive number of blue bonds issued. Sounds great to me. I think one of the key aspects for me is really saying who gets to decide who gets, you know, in the front of the queue. Those who are at the front of the queue, they are also responsible for the rest of the industry. They should realize that, especially those who are not very keen on having to be in compliance, not very keen on having robust reporting structures. What's really important is that they have developed a sense of responsibility and realize that if they don't represent this industry correctly, they are literally also going to shoot their future funding and our future funding in the foot. And so that's what I feel is really important to get right at the beginning. You know, we need to unlock, you know, all of these sources of capital for not just the blue economy, but all climate-related investments. And, you know, we also need the investment community, the financial community to not be lazy. Don't just go and buy an online report or, you know, pay a consultant to do the job for you. Go actively source, look at the project origination, visit them, you know, talk to them, ask questions, ask stupid questions, whatever it is, right? You know, if you want to talk about risk mitigation, the best way to do that is by like, you know, getting involved, upskilling themselves. And I think like, you know, that's also another consideration with regards to blue bonds that I think is very, very, very important, not talked about enough.
Thank you. I also want to talk about one other topic more related to international collaboration and governance. In March 2023, so last year, a historic agreement was reached at the United Nations for High Seas Treaty, which aims to place 30% of the world's oceans into marine protected areas. What would you say, to what extent is international collaboration essential for addressing challenges related to the blue economy and ocean conservation? And what would you say, how important was this agreement and what was the context of this agreement?
The High Seas Treaty. This is a treaty that, I mean, Singapore has been vital in participation in the High Seas Treaty. And I believe, It was also a Singaporean that was able to break the gridlock. You know, this is something that's taken about 20 years to come to fruition. You know, very difficult to hold individual countries, right, to account, because you have official meetings, you have, like, you know, behind the scenes, closed door diplomatic sessions. And then, of course, you had COVID, things were delayed. And then you also have various disputes arising because of whether it's funding, whether it's fishing rights, if we want to be specific to this region, right? We are talking about a lot of tension within the South China Sea. You know, so when you talk about collaboration, like, you see all of these, I mean, I was sitting in not High Seas Treaty talks, but I was sitting in INC2, which is about the global plastic pollution discussions in Paris. People are sitting, people are disagreeing, and then go for lunch. And then, you know, we are printing papers. I say I did this. No, you say you did this. This is different. I think, like, what's happening is we use the word collaboration, but we're also really ignoring what is at stake. Governments want to ensure their country's position. Governments negotiate based on their country's strategic interests. You're only going to achieve collaboration if a skillful negotiator is able to navigate all of these strategic interests. You know, so with the High Seas Treaty, we are talking about governing the ungovernable. We are talking about, you know, international waters. We are talking about preservation of the common heritage of humankind. We're talking about biodiversity. We are talking about the international seabed. We are talking about areas that, because it is in international waters, for the longest time has not been governed. And we are trying to create a treaty to create a structure, framework of governance. Governance only works if there is a vehicle to police. How do we enforce the consequences of breaking the tenets of the treaty? Mm-hmm. Enforcement is the major issue. If we're going to talk about, we have a treaty that clearly identifies which areas of the international seabed cannot be mined, but we have bad players, bad actors who are mining in said areas. What is the penalty? What are the consequences to them for infringing the High Seas Treaty? Secondly, I spend a lot of time speaking to other NGOs in the region. There was an NGO that we spoke to. It's led by an indigenous lady, and she has been going out, sometimes in armed boats, to chase away illegal sand dredgers, right? And they are also armed, and they're starting to seize some of these illegal sand dredging ships are also starting to arm themselves. So when we come into point number two of the High Seas Treaty, talking about freedom of seas, heritage of mankind, preservation of a nation's seabed, or even sand, coastal sands, you know, what's the penalty for this particular vessel that was infringing that right? When an indigenous person tries to assert that right, you know, like, are they now contravening laws by arming themselves to try and, like, you know, match the aggression that is coming? So there's so much of difficulty with articulating and navigating these treaties by enforcing this as well. So this is, again, where we're in 2024. If we want to combat, like, you know, failure of implementation or foresight or difficulty for us to kind of, like, you know, have consequences, all of these things are very easily combated by technology. You have satellite systems that can basically map the entire world and tell you where a vessel is going to be at what time. You have even undersea mapping systems that are able to also understand whether there has been illegal mining, illegal drilling, dredging. You have real-time systems that can already tell whether you know, an illegal fleet has infringed upon another nation's right and then entered into their waters under the pretext of something else. Technology is already able to answer the questions of failures of implementation. The question is, are we ready to implement? And here's what's really funny. The same technology is used to govern the shipping industry? Because this is about maximization of profit, right? Why aren't we able to turn the same tool on the other side, right? Making sure that our oceans are safe. I spend a lot of time thinking about these crazy things and, like, you know, I'm trying to challenge the industry to do better, and also looking within industries to look at how their structures are put together and figuring out how we repurpose that for the sustainable blue economy.
Mm-hmm. You already talked about the important role of technology and how technology can address many of these difficulties. But in the beginning of this episode, we talked also about nature-based solutions. What would you say, what's the more effective strategy for protecting oceans and preventing pollution? Is it more based on technology and trying to enhance the usage of emerging technologies? Or would you say nature-based solutions are more powerful? Or is it the mix?
Yeah, I think it's both. You know, like, that's also why at Ocean Purpose Project, we do both. The plastic to hydrogen is really about clean tech, deep tech. It's about mobilizing multiple forms of innovation across different sectors. There's the energy sector, there's the plastic sector, there's the hydrogen sector, you know, so maritime sector as well. So this is, again, where, you know, you're going to need that. You're also going to say not everything requires multi-million dollar, like, you know, like high-tech solution. In Singapore, we're a little bit addicted to that, right? Oh, it's got to be high-tech, it got to have AI. Then the VC investor will just drop like 1 million in your lap, right? So it's like, yeah. This is also where, like, you know, the other project that we work on, which is our bioremediation, is the exact opposite. It's about low cost. It's about easy to implement. It's about mobilizing indigenous and traditional people, using native species, not just nature-based solutions. It's about saying, hey, academia doesn't know everything there is to know about marine biology. The people who work for generations in seafood industry also have so much to bring to the table. You know, the original First Nations people of the land have so much of knowledge to add, and we need to amalgamate this knowledge. And I think this is, again, where we are reading, we are digesting, we are ideating, but at Ocean Purpose Project, we're taking it to the next step. We're literally saying a beach cleanup is not going to save the world or the sea. We have to do the tough stuff. We have to get even deeper. You know, we have to understand, like, you know, a lot harder issues that is at work. We also have to figure out, how do we map the different people who live in a town, the different economic activities, and say, this is what is required for us, not just to solve plastic pollution or pollution for that matter in our seas, but to actually create new markets and opportunities, to create, for example, new possibilities around ocean conservation, and really mobilize everybody who lives in that particular town to be able to do that. It's microeconomy, right? So this is, again, very, very important for us to talk about it, to promote it, but to also show by doing, this is what we have learned through our prototypes and our implementation. And not everything is like a smashing success, you know, that appears on CNN and it's like, wow, so successful. No, no. I can tell you, 9 times out of 10, it's a, you know, there's a lot more failures than there are successes. But the mapping and the charting of the failures is very interesting, because then what it does is that it opens the pathway for solutioning to enter. And that is actually the space that we are trying to promote, that, you know, appearing on this podcast. That's why I wanted to do this, because the world is so obsessed with this bright, shiny vision of successful blue economy startup that, like, you know, and when it all comes crashing down, it's like, oh, what a failure. We're so eager to hoist them on the shoulder and then also to kick them off, right? And then we will be in this loop of extreme rise and fail and rise and fail, instead of steadily saying, let's logically look at projects, start small, fail fast, and then slowly, you know, iterate and move, creep it forward, right? And that's really also kind of where we see various different forms of solutioning coming to the fore. You know, the world has been talking about climate tech solutions, about nature-based solutions. We haven't brought indigenous solutions to the table. I got irritated after a while when I was at the UN INC2 in Paris. So I went to the cafe opposite the street. I was sitting in the cafe and I was like, I'm going to have a glass of wine and, like, you know, and just like sit and think for a moment. And there was a First Nations gentleman, an indigenous gentleman from Texas, of all places, who I don't know why he looked at me. He started talking to me and we had a riveting conversation about IP. So Eva, when I say IP, what do you think I'm talking about?
That's a good question. Maybe the property of the cultural heritage of the people who live in these areas. I'm not quite sure. Maybe you can explain what it is.
Yeah, usually IP, you think about intellectual property right?
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with this fantastic, it was so interesting and riveting what he was saying. He said he is going to file suit the next day or to create something called indigenous property. And I was like, oh, expand. So according to him, you know, there are historical documents that claim that, you know, there were the first settlers that came to Texas and his ancestors were the first villagers that they met. And that, you know, how to turn tobacco into something that you smoke, or, you know, the properties of indigenous fruits and vegetables and crops was documented by those first settlers. And it was credited to this particular individual, indigenous people or indigenous leaders of these tribes, who taught the settler what is the use of the crop and et cetera, et cetera. He's filing a suit that this is a precedence that very clearly states that this, the knowledge of these crops, the IP of how to turn this into products, is actually originating from the indigenous people because of this historical account. And he's going to set a precedence, right, that IP now belongs in, is not intellectual property, it's indigenous property, which blew my mind. And I was like, wow, this is a fantastic conversation we are having at the side of a cafe in France, right? I mean, of course, all great ideas are born on the corner of a cafe in Paris. But this again, where, like, you know, I was like, whoa, this is lacking, you know, indigenous solutions that are low cost, traditional, filled with cultural heritage, filled with an understanding of relationship to the land. These are the third wave of solutions that are not talked about, that are not celebrated. And I, as the CEO of Ocean Purpose Project, I'm adamant that this is what we are also going to pull into our projects. And we are also trying our very best to articulate that knowledge, not at big conferences all over the world, but in our hometown first.
Thank you so much for all the information and sharing all this with us. Maybe one last question. What would you advise or what would you recommend to people who want to take action and to take part in the ocean conservation and protection? What actions can they take? What is helpful? What is necessary? And what can the impact of one person or one single individual be?
I think what you said, take action. By doing, we then understand a little bit more. So, for example, we had a beach cleanup organized for a major petrochemical company. And I insisted that the people who are attending, who are the staff of this petrochemical, to attend with their children. Then we take the project. And what was really interesting is that you had the children of these chemical engineers, by the way, from this petrochemical company, who were picking up all of this plastic and this at sea. And they were like, what is this? Who came up with this product? Why is it everywhere? Who is throwing it? Who is genius, you know, like thought that, like, you use something for so many seconds and then it is here for, you know, breaking up into pieces and it's here for an eternity. What is going on? And you see, like, you know, the parents are like, oh my God. And this is just a 1-2 hour session is able to change the mindset of people working as chemical engineers in a petrochem. This 2-hour session where their children are the ones asking very innocent but very, very clear, straightforward questions. This session is more valuable than if I'm standing on the stage showing a deck, making a video, doing a TikTok dance. This is again where, like, you know, when we come back about individual actions people can take. Something as simple as a 2-hour beach cleanup where you have a very precocious 8-year-old questioning their mother and father and saying, who invented this? Who is the genius? How can you do this? This doesn't make sense. Aren't you going to do better? Simple things like this can already cause a company to soul search and to look for tangible solutions. And this is again where, you know, I encourage people to get hands-on, volunteer, help, you know, support social enterprises like ourselves in what we're doing. Donate to us, participate. Don't just give us money, come participate, you know, tell us what you help do you need. Even if you are not like a marine biologist or engineer, maybe you are a marketer, you're an accountant, maybe you are, you know, you're an artist, you're a singer. You know, everybody has a skill that they can put to being able to take action as long as it is something of yourself. If it is something that you are giving of yourself that is, you know, difficult for you to give, that is effort for you, then that is what we need. We don't need people who are trying to make their LinkedIn look more fancy, students trying to show how many volunteer arrangement I have collected so that I can get like a better job, or, you know, we don't need more of this fancy show-off stuff. We need people to give of themselves, give the difficult things of themselves, give that time, give that effort, and participate and help and support. And that is really where, in that space of helping and supporting. So to share with you, before I started Ocean Purpose Project, I did a cleanup with every single NGO in Singapore that does beach cleanups. I've participated, I've volunteered with all of them. I've actually gone off and helped a lot of them. You know, so this is again where, like, I'm not here saying, oh, do my cleanup, don't do their cleanup. I'm literally saying, I've actually gone off and tried and tested and helped and supported and did the tough stuff. Then I realized, like, something's missing here. And this is again where, in that action, my hope is that people will then go, hey, what if we tried it this way? Maybe this could be done better. Maybe I could suggest this person to this person. And that's how the industry grows, how the industry improves, how we all get better. It's this like allergic reaction to consistency, to hard work, to being committed to something, to, you know, even putting in effort. That's literally where we are at right now. And what we really need is for people to get uncomfortable and to also, like, you know, give more of themselves in order for them to push the needle forward.
Matilda, thank you so much for your time and all the interesting insights and information you shared with us today. I really enjoyed talking to you about the current state of ocean conservation and the important role of oceans regarding climate change. And thank you very much also for giving insights into the work of Ocean Purpose Project and your personal journey. If this episode has piqued your interest and you have more questions, check out the website of Ocean Purpose Project. And if you want to read more about today's topic, I highly recommend the latest article of Positive Investment Imperial, or PII. Positive Investment Imperial is a student-led organization at Imperial College London dedicated to raising awareness around sustainable and responsible investment at Imperial and across the UK through advising, research and events. Check out the latest article about the blue economy. To everyone listening, I hope you've enjoyed this episode with Matilda De Silva. If you'd like to hear more insights, don't forget to subscribe to the Imperial Business Podcast. And if you have any suggestions or know the perfect guest for us to interview, please drop us a message at podcast.greenminds@gmail.com. Thank you for listening and see you soon.